Light is sweet, and it is pleasant for the eyes to see the sun. So, if a person lives many years, let him rejoice in them all. But let him remember that the days of darkness will be many. All that comes is vanity. Rejoice, O young man, in your youth, and let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Walk in the ways of your heart and the sight of your eyes. But know that for all these things God will bring you into judgment. Remove vexation from your heart and put away pain from your body, for youth and the dawn of life are vanity. Remember also your Creator in the days of your youth, before the evil days come and the years draw near, of which you will say, I have no pleasure in them, before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars are darkened and the clouds return after the rain, in the day when the keepers of the house tremble and the strong men are bent and the grinders cease because they are few, and those who look through the windows are dimmed, and the doors on the street are shut. When the sound of the grinding is low, and one rises up at the sound of a bird, and all the daughters of song are brought low. They are afraid also of what is high, and terrors are in the way. The almond tree blossoms, the grasshopper drags itself along, and desire fails, because man is going to his eternal home, and the mourners go about the streets. Before the silver cord is snapped, or the golden bowl is broken, or the pitcher is shattered at the fountain, or the wheel broken at the cistern, and the dust returns to the earth as it was, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. Vanity of vanity, says the preacher, all is vanity. Besides being wise, the preacher also taught the people knowledge, weighing and studying and arranging many proverbs with great care. The preacher sought to find words of delight, and uprightly he wrote words of truth. The words of the wise are like goads and like nails firmly fixed, are the collected sayings. They are given by one shepherd. My son, beware of anything beyond these. Of making many books there is no end, and much study is a weariness of the flesh. The end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil. We have skipped over a few chapters since we met last evening, and one of the big themes, especially at the end of chapter 8 and right through chapter 9, which we've skipped over, is the challenge of living in a world which is not simply challenging, as we're thinking about in chapter 7, but is actually chaotic. What I mean by that is we assume that in a well-governed universe, it would look like this. Bad stuff would happen to bad people and good stuff would happen to good people. That's what we should expect. If the universe was well governed, we think. But each of us will have lived long enough on this earth to know that is not really what happens. Just to skim back to 8:14, as Solomon puts it, there are righteous people to whom it happens according to the deeds of the wicked, and there are wicked people to whom it happens according to the deeds of the righteous. And that's a neat way of saying life as we experience it is just a mess. It is a jungle out there. And on the face of it, there is little to suggest that the universe is well governed at all. In fact, and you'll be able to multiply examples in your experience, but even in the last month, I've heard about two mothers of school-aged children, one a relative, one a friend of the family, who have been diagnosed with cancer, one of whom, at least, there's no prospect of recovery. And it just, when you hear these kinds of stories, it just seems arbitrary. You know, why them? It doesn't seem to add up. And Solomon knows that one of the ways we tend to respond to living in a chaotic world is that we start living, not just trying to build heaven here, which is what we're thinking about in session one, not just trying to be control freaks, as we're thinking about in session two. Not just becoming grumblers, perhaps, as we're thinking about in session three, but one of the ways we respond to a chaotic world is that we decide to live defensively. We try and live cautiously and anxiously. So yes, there are things in life that we could throw ourselves into. There are opportunities, there are dreams, there are ambitions, there are areas of service, there are relationships, but it never seems quite the right time. And after all, the priority right now has to be getting that qualification, securing that job, getting that financial security, doing whatever it is that which we think will be able to shield us against whatever might happen just over the horizon. And Solomon's message throughout this book has been not simply to be realistic about this life. It is a chaotic, it is a fallen world. But he wants us also to know how knowing God helps us to live wisely and positively in the midst of this chaos. And in these final verses in this section of the book, he's going to show us how to live joyfully and how to live reverently in the midst of the chaos. How to live positively. So first, it's on your sheets or on the screens, he calls us to live joyfully now, precisely because life is fleeting and temporary and insecure. Let's have a look at verse 7. Light is sweet, and it is pleasant for the eyes to see the sun. So if a person lives many years, let him rejoice in them all. And this is session 4, so you'll be getting the theme now of Ecclesiastes. The big message here, again and again, is enjoy life. Carpe diem is the Latin phrase, is seize the day, live large. The film Dead Poets Society has a famous scene where the school teacher, played by Robin Williams, says to the boys, carpe diem, seize the day, gentlemen. And then he says, believe it or not, each and every one of us in this room is one day going to stop breathing, turn cold and die. And then he invites them into the corridor of the school and he invites them to examine the faces from all those faded black and white photos, team photos in the school corridor. And he says, you see, gentlemen, these boys are now fertilising daffodils. But if you listen closely, you can hear them whisper their legacy to you. And they all crowd to the glass. And then he whispers, do you hear it? Carpe diem. Seize the day, boys. Now, for those in the room who have been born since that film came out in 1989, and who maybe aren't so familiar with Latin, the modern translation of carpe diem is this. Someone who's been born since 1989, what does that mean? You only live once. And however you express it, however you translate it, I think that is actually a very fitting summary of verses 7 to 9. Life is short, death is coming, you only live once, so make the most of it. So let's listen out for that logic in these verses as I read them. Why don't I go right from verse 7 down to 10. 7. Light is sweet and it is pleasant for the eyes to see the sun, so if a person lives many years, let him rejoice in them all. But let him remember that the days of darkness will be many. All that comes is vapour. Rejoice, O young man, in your youth, and let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Walk in the ways of your heart and the sight of your eyes. But know that for all these things, God will bring you into judgment. Remove vexation from your heart and put away pain from your body, for youth and the dawn of life are vanity. Now, incidentally, we mentioned, didn't we, what that word vanity, the root word hebel, what it literally means. Can anyone remind us? I think I even just said it just now. I would love you to go away, vapour. This is the one that says play, so you're not going to have cleaning fluid on you. I would love you to remember it next time you're reading Ecclesiastes, to gloss this in your mind and just to think vapour. And do you remember the two things that it could refer to when we think of vapour? One of which is... Yeah, you can't grasp hold of it, you can't understand it, it's just not neat. And the other one, Bonnie, very helpfully, fleeting, so it's temporary. So two ways that, one thing is you can't grasp it, you can't hang on to it, you can't understand it in that sense, but also it's gone, it doesn't last, it doesn't hang around. And verse 10 here, I think, is a brilliant example of how it just cannot mean meaninglessness or vanity. Because in the context, Solomon's just been saying how precious youth is, not how pointless it is. And so the point here in verse 10 is that youth and the dawn of life are vapour. They're fleeting. They don't last. Do you see? It's not quite the same as meaningless. It just doesn't hang around. So Solomon is teaching carpe diem. You only live once. And I guess some of us will be thinking, in fact I hope that we're thinking, if we're familiar with other themes in the Bible, isn't that the slogan of the hedonist, we ask? Live for now. Live. Isn't that, you know, what the hedonist says? Live indulgently today without any regard for the consequences. And surely the Christian, by contrast, we say, is to live with their focus on the world to come, aren't they? Pete mentioned the bucket list. I recently watched the film The Bucket List, which I'm afraid I can't wholeheartedly recommend. And the Morgan Freeman character in the film, he gets told that he's dying, and immediately he leaves his wife and his family and he heads off round the world, ticking off his various dreams and ambitions, all the things he wants to do before he kicks the bucket. And surely that kind of selfish hedonism cannot be what Solomon is calling us to, surely. Here in verse 9, when Solomon teaches the young man here, walk in the ways of your heart and the sight of your eyes, when we read that, we're thinking, surely that is the opposite of the advice that you're meant to give to the youth group, isn't it? You're not meant to say, walk in the ways of your heart and the sight of your eyes. You're meant to say, listen, the ways of your heart are wicked. Whatever you do, youth group, young men in Ecclesiastes, don't do that. Walk exactly the other way. But of course, Solomon here is talking to a believer. It's written to someone who fears the Lord and to someone who is already one of the Lord's people. It's a bit like when Nathan said to King David in 2 Samuel 7, go, do all that is in your heart, for the Lord is with you. And Solomon's saying, look, if you fear the Lord, maybe some of the things in your heart are going to be excellent things. Maybe as you see that sports team to join, or that property to develop, or that godly girl to get to know, or maybe those are just the things that you should be pursuing. If there's a course that you want to study, go and do it. If there's a knitting pattern you want to master, off you go. If there's an area of ministry you want to pursue, go for it. Verse 9, but know that for all these things, God will bring you into judgment. So don't do those things like some foolish idolater would do them, who thinks they can get ultimate gain from them, or ultimate security, or ultimate satisfaction. No, do these things as a creature who is living in dependence on God, and seeing each part of our lives as a chance to love God and to know him better. So do that anthropology course, but sit in every lecture delighting in the God he made you and in the complexity and beauty of the people that he's made. So knit that new pattern, but produce every stitch in a spirit of thankfulness. Get stuck into that ministry, but do it in dependence on the Lord and consciously for his glory. And supremely, verse 9, do it all looking to his well done on the day of judgment. As Paul tells the slaves in Colossians 3, whatever you do, work heartily, as for the Lord and not for men, knowing that from the Lord you will receive the inheritance as your reward. Whatever we do it wholeheartedly, and yet let's do it looking to his reward. Just like we read here in Ecclesiastes. Because it's the 500th year of the Reformation, we did a little Heroes of the Reformation series over the summer, and one of the people we looked at was Martin Luther, the 16th century German reformer. And he was someone who really understood well the Bible's teaching about the importance of enjoying God's gifts today. I'm going to read now a little extract from a letter that he wrote to Prince Joachim of Anhalt in 1534. Luther writes, "I should like to encourage your grace, who are a young man, always to be joyful, to engage in riding and hunting, and to seek the company of others who may be able to rejoice with your grace in a godly and honourable way. No one realises how much harm it does to a young person to avoid pleasure and cultivate solitude and sadness. Your grace has Master Nicholas Hausmann and many others near at hand. Be merry with them." It's just like here in verse 9. "Rejoice, O young man, in your youth. Let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. For, Luther says, for gladness and good cheer, when decent and proper, are the best medicine for a young person, indeed for all people. I myself, who have spent a good part of my life in sorrow and gloom," and you know that his days as a monk were not very lively, "I now seek and find joy wherever I can. Praise God, we now have sufficient understanding of the Word of God to be able to rejoice with a good conscience and to use God's gifts with thanksgiving, for he created them for this purpose and is pleased when we use them." And you can hear the echo there of Paul's words to Timothy in 1 Timothy 4. "For everything created by God is good, and nothing is to be rejected if it's received with thanksgiving." And the following verses, which we just read, chapter 12, 1 to 8, and they have that beautiful poem about ageing. Marcus was telling me this was one of his English literature exercises, was to analyse this poem back at school. But this poem gives us even more motivation to live joyfully now, precisely because life is fleeting and insecure and that we're only young once. Chapter 12, verse 1. "Remember also your Creator, the one who created this good world full of things to enjoy. Remember also your Creator in the days of your youth, before the evil days come and the years draw near, of which you will say, I have no pleasure in them." And Solomon's warning us here in verse 1 not to keep putting off living life until some vague time in the future. I wonder if you've thought of this, but there will never be a day in this life when you and I can hear and see and exercise as well as we can today. And Solomon is saying, make the most of it. Verse 2, "Before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars are darkened and the clouds return after the rain." I think this is still, well, we have to ask someone who's studied it in English literature, but I think this is still talking about the end of a person's life. It's using imagery now, though, about the end of the world, this kind of apocalyptic language in verse 2. And it's saying that every person's death is in some sense like the end of creation as they experience what it is to be unmade. And the verses then continue to describe the end of a person's life, but next they switch the imagery to that of a deteriorating old village. Look at verse 3. "In the day when the keepers of the house tremble," perhaps that's the arms, "and the strong men are bent," that's probably the legs, "and the grinders cease because they are few," I guess that's the teeth dropping out, "and those who look through the windows are dimmed," that's the eyesight failing, "and the doors on the street are shut," perhaps that's the mouth caving in, "when the sound of the grinding is low, and one rises up at the sound of a bird." Old people are often very light sleepers. "And all the daughters of song are brought low," all the music's gone in life. Verse 5, "they're afraid also of what is high, and terrors are in the way, and anxieties grow even about normal things in old age. The almond tree blossoms, that might be grey hair. The grasshopper drags itself along and desire fails. I guess that's sexual ability and desire starting to diminish. Because man is going to his eternal home. And the mourners go about the streets. And the poem here is assuming that death actually starts breaking in and interrupting life even before it finally comes to us. But then, of course, it comes. Verse 6. Before the silver cord is snapped, or the golden bowl is broken, or the pitcher is shattered at the fountain, or the wheel broken at the cistern, and the dust returns to the earth as it was, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. It's talking there about that final irreversible moment when the vessels break and the liquid escapes. And it's a picture of that moment when the body finally breaks down and the spirit returns to God. Vapor of vapors, verse 8, says the preacher. All is vapor. It's all fleeting. It's all temporary. And all of this is given to us to send the message home to us as loudly and as clearly as possible that we are to live joyfully now, precisely because life is fleeting and because aging and death is unavoidable. So it's good for us, think back just today over some of the gifts that we've enjoyed. Perhaps we've had legs that work. Perhaps we've had food that tasted as De Vere breakfasts do. Perhaps we've had people we love around us. Perhaps we've been able to show kindness or care in some way. And one day we will look back on days like today and we will say, well, those were the days. And one of the take-home messages of Ecclesiastes for me has been trying to develop the habit day by day of saying to myself, these are the days. Don't wish them away. Value them. Give thanks to them. These are the days. Incidentally, this teaching from Ecclesiastes may be a useful corrective for some of us who sometimes feel guilty when we start to enjoy God's gifts in this world. Perhaps for us, we've rightly understood the urgency of the gospel. We know that nothing matters more than for people to be in right relationship with God before the judgment comes. And yet it's possible to take that truth and, neglecting other parts of God's revelation, to twist that truth into an unbiblical reductionism. The kind of message that says all that counts now is evangelism and that anything else is just rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic, as the phrase goes. And that kind of reductionism can make us devalue our created physicality. And so we start treating food as just fuel. And marriage becomes either a distraction or possibly just a means of evangelistic efficiency or something frightening like that. And our work becomes merely a place to earn money for Christian mission. And friendships just become functional and mercenary. And Ecclesiastes helpfully reminds us that in saving us, God is restoring us to our true created humanity. In fact, given that the serpent's lie from Genesis 3 was that God is mean-spirited and harsh, our job as believers is not to try and reinforce that lie. We're not to try and give the impression that God has made this wonderful world only to forbid his creatures from enjoying it. No, our job is to live thankful and joyful lives, which point upwards to our Creator's goodness and generosity. And it's precisely because Solomon's message is so radical, not just to those of, you know, who have this reductionist view of life, but actually to all kinds of people who just read this and think it sounds unspiritual in some way. And it's so radical that it's important for us to hear the necessary sales pitch at the end of this book. The last few verses here are not written by Solomon, the preacher, but by an editor or publisher. And verses 9 to 14 function a little bit like the blurb on the back of a book. And I picked a German book there, so some of us would be less likely to spend the rest of the talk just trying to read it, although I can see Rosemary is probably about to. And this blurb here at the end of Ecclesiastes is to convince us that it's worth our while heeding this book's message. Verse 9, have a look. Besides being wise, the preacher also taught the people knowledge, weighing and studying and arranging many proverbs with great care. So Ecclesiastes is a challenging book. Sometimes I've been grappling for ages with how each verse follows on from the last. And the temptation would be to say, well, perhaps it's just random. Perhaps it's miscellaneous. Solomon just wasn't very clued up and didn't write very carefully. And this verse has been an encouragement to me to keep grappling, because we're specifically told it has all been carefully arranged. That's why we're to work hard at the Bible. Verse 10. The preacher sought to find words of delight, and uprightly he wrote words of truth. The words of the wise are like goads, and like nails firmly fixed are the collected sayings. They're given by one shepherd. My son, beware of anything beyond these. Of making many books there is no end, and much study is a weariness of the flesh. And this really is a glowing 5-star review on the back of the book. It's saying that Ecclesiastes is not just beautifully written, which it is, but it's completely reliable in its message, verse 10. And that is because the message comes from God himself, verse 11, the great shepherd of the sheep. And that is why, verse 12, it is all we need. We don't need to add a sequel to it. And goads in verse 11, they are the sharp spikes on the end of a shepherd's stick for prodding sheep who are starting to wander off in the wrong direction. And so it's an acknowledgement that it may be uncomfortable reading when we read Ecclesiastes. It is like goads, but it's supremely precious because it's how God keeps us on track as the great shepherd. Now, it's this paragraph that actually explains the approach we've taken to the book this weekend. I mentioned at the beginning that there are different takes, different, say, commentaries or preaching series we may have heard, sometimes say something like this: poor Solomon, if only he knew what we know about eternal life, then he wouldn't be so depressed. Well, at least he shows us how meaningless life would be if God didn't exist. That's somehow sometimes how the book is approached, as though Ecclesiastes is essentially sub-Christian. And if that's what we're thinking, it's worth considering for a moment why this book needs this sales pitch at the end. I can't think of any other Bible book quite like this that has the sales pitch. And surely it's because God knows how quick we are to dismiss the message of Ecclesiastes, to think it sounds unspiritual perhaps. And the writer wants us to know that, challenging as it is, this book is exactly what the great shepherd wants his sheep to hear. So there we have it. That was our necessary interlude, the necessary sales pitch in the middle. But now our final point comes from the final conclusion of the whole book. And I put there, live reverently, in fear of God, because all of life is significant. Verse 13, the end of the matter, all has been heard. Here's the big conclusion. It's always a help as a reader when a writer tells you the summary of everything he said. All has been heard, fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. Why? Verse 14, for God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil. We've already seen, even in today's verses, chapter 11, verse 9, this teaching about judgment. And it is wonderful, wonderful news. Do you remember the book began in chapter 1, verse 3 with this question: what does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? And Solomon has been opening our eyes to the fact that God has deliberately frustrated this life, so that we cannot make the lasting difference we want to. As we saw yesterday, we're just making sandcastles whilst the tide comes in. But the wonderful news Solomon has been bringing us is that although we cannot bring lasting gain ourselves, we can entrust gain to God. Verse 14, God will bring every deed into judgment. Think about that for a moment. God will bring every deed into judgment. Everything we do has lasting significance, ultimately. Isn't that good news? I think often when we think of judgment, we do think of it negatively, and understandably so, because, of course, if we face the judgment unforgiven, then we're in desperate danger. And please, if you're unsure about whether you will be safe on that day, can I really urge you not to go home without talking to someone, getting clear on these things? It won't be the first time on a barge weekend away that somebody has decided to make that step at this stage of the weekend. And do that if that's you. Nothing could matter more. But for those of us who, and I guess this will be the vast majority, who know that we're forgiven, who know that we are justified before God, something we're going to celebrate in a moment in the Lord's Supper. For those of us who are in that situation, the fact of judgment is now a wonderful thing to think about. I guess we've all come across school teachers who didn't care enough to mark the students' work properly. In fact, I heard about some naughty kids who put this to the test by writing rude things about the teacher in the middle of the essay just to see if the teacher would notice. And as soon as the children work out that there's no real assessment of what they do, that is deeply demotivating. They just disengage. I was listening to a TED talk a while back by a professor of psychology, and he was saying that this sense that there is no ultimate assessment and therefore no ultimate meaning in life is what accounts for why so many people in our society plunge into depression, he said, because it's so demoralising. And Solomon assures us here at the close of the book that everything matters. And can I say that this is a deeply practical doctrine? Even in the last few days, I have taken strength and comfort from the fact that even if others don't see what I'm doing or perhaps don't appreciate it, there is a God who does. And as Jesus says in the parable of the tenants, he will one day say to us, "Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a little. I will set you over much. Enter into the joy of your master." And so Solomon's call on us is to fear God, to live lives that reverence him in everything we do. We thought at the beginning about, given the chaotic world we live in, the world that doesn't seem to be well governed so much of the time, there is that temptation for us to live defensively, to live cautiously, to live anxiously. And wonderfully, in these verses, we see that Solomon shows us a much better way. And his liberating news for us is that reverence for God and reveling in life are not opposites, and they should always go together. And whilst there's no question we all live the entire length of our lives, we all live until our dying day, his call to us is to make sure we live the entire width of our lives in joyful worship of him.